Dick Gillespie. This is the Reason TV talk show with my co-host Michael C. Moynihan of Reason and our guest Steve Clemens of the New America Foundation and proprietor of the WashingtonNote.com website and former speech writer for George W. Bush, author of most recently of Comeback, and also the head of the NewMajority.com website, David Frum. David, as a speechwriter, a presidential speechwriter, best known for the evil of access phrase, yes? What'd you think of Obama's speech at the inauguration?
It was strangely disappointing. And it's strange because we all know, I mean, if Obama can do anything, right, he can give a speech. My feeling with that one is that no human individual could have written a speech quite as boring as that. It took a team of trained experts, professionals, to produce it. But
they even brought in a poet to make it look good after the fact.
Exactly.
But what it offered, if the poetry of the speech was lacking, the prose was very strong. It offered a very clear left turn signal about the direction which he intends to take the country. And I think.
How do you mean in that? In the phrase that he's talking about, the questions about the economy.
Right.
Or the free market economy can't really do it alone.
Right. Well, I've been parsing the speech very carefully. And when you look at what he is saying, first he talks about the need for government investment. But then he says, but we're going to make sure that it makes the economy grow. Then he endorses wind power and solar power, which, of course, don't meet any kind of market test. I mean, if you're going to get rid of coal, a goal I applaud, you go to nuclear. That's the cheapest source. So he's indicating that spending is not going to have to meet tests of efficiency and cost effectiveness. And then he played this very interesting game with his defense of regulation. He began by talking about the market, leading people to think he meant financial markets, but also in context suggesting, no, I mean the market generally, and that is all going to have to be under a more watchful eye. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of signals there about the directions in which he'd like to go, but because he's so cautious and tentative and unwilling to make to expose himself to criticism, he didn't say it in the forceful way that would have been a clarion call to those who support him.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what do you think?
I mean, I largely agree with David. I as I listened to this speech, I was shocked that, you know, when you have 2 million or more on that National Mall, and this is going to be one of the speeches you would think would be one of the great ones, given what we know about Barack Obama, it was a fairly timid speech. And you have to say, what were they thinking? They must have known. And I think it was a setting expectation speech. I think it was odd that they used that moment to do this, but when you compare it to Bush's, you know, very lofty 2004 address that set an agenda for what America might achieve in the world and pushing democracy. If you look back at another president that Obama's often compared to, John Kennedy, this had none of that lofty prose and rhetoric either. And so I think it was very odd that this was a setting expectations of talking about, you know, the massive problems that face the nation, and it was a reminder to Americans that they need to get over their problems, begin working, because tough times are coming. What's odd is, behind the scenes, you had Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter stiffing each other when they were meeting. It was a nice little ABC report on how cold and chilly they were. And I was saying to myself, wow, if Obama can't get Carter and Clinton to talk, it's going to be a problem for the country.
But isn't he smart to have as low expectations as possible? And certainly Bush has set the bar extremely low. I mean, we're coming out of an eight-year period with, quite possibly, certainly in modern history, the least popular and widely considered the least successful presidency.
But if you wanted to lower expectations, why wouldn't you begin with a very stark description of how bad things are? Not in a vague way, but be very precise.
I don't think he can, because things are not that bad.
Well,
within even anybody's memory here, things have been much worse in the U.S. I was getting the declinism without even being delivered the goods.
But he could have given, if you want to sort of lower people's expectations for your business, you begin by painting a very stark picture of how bad things are. And even if you have to deploy some rhetorical excess, say, here are the problems we face. But we are not, the message should be, but we're not daunted. We've got a plan, and here's my plan. And you can do, and then you can have some fine language within that. But bad writing and good writing actually always work in the same way. Bad writing starts from the outside in. It begins with the phrases and works to the ideas. Good writing works from the inside out. It begins with the ideas and then has the phrasing. So, and one of the things that always happens with these inaugurals, and I've seen it, they begin with a search for phrases. What can we do that is our equivalent of fear itself or ask not? You start with the phrasing, and the writers go crazy. They all have been planning this since high school. And that is how you got a guaranteed bad speech.
The good one. Speech. This was the good
ones.
Speech.
The great ones phrase, all start with
what
an idea.
What phrase would you have gone to?
You know, the funny thing is that when I was thinking about
in
this
high
morning,
school, I'm
in,
about.
Oh, in high school, yeah, yeah. Well, my high school speeches were great. They were I wrote for Henry Cabot Lodge in high school. The one thing I was thinking of this morning is when I woke up and I haven't parsed the speech yet. I watched it yesterday, and I'm thinking this morning, what phrases did I take away from that? What is right. the? And there is nothing really memorable, which is especially surprising because I completely agree with what you're saying, and especially in the context of seeing the story on Drudge that there were four or five. Outside people like Doris Kearns Goodwin, who were consulted to, you know, make this sort of FDR, LBJ, I mean, LBJ, JFK sort of right. speech. And I'm coming away from this saying, you know, what the hell did I just hear?
Yeah,
which is an amazing thing about the speech.
I thought it would take at least 17 to make a speech.
Well, yeah, I think there were four or five people outside of the Obama circle.
I think it's called the bad weather speech because all of the metaphors were weather, clouds. Right. So it'll be called Obama's bad weather speech.
Yeah, there's a cold wind.
But, you know, the other thing that was odd about this speech is I've been joking that we've replaced the housing bubble in America with an Obama bubble. And to some degree, Obama it's important for that bubble to remain there. And like an economic bubble before it bursts, you get a lot of investment in capacity. And the trick with bubbles that work is you get a railroad system that lays. You get an IT infrastructure that survives. And Obama's challenge is going to be able to use this period of the bubble that he's got to try to create enough infrastructure.
So what's he going to do? I mean, Steve, you're widely reputed to be a Marxist, if not a Hegelian.
If not a Hegelian communist. Yeah,
David Frum weak moment.
Okay, but what is it in his flush of popularity? He's coming in with higher numbers than the average president. What do you want to see him do? What do you want to see him waste money on?
Well, there's no way this guy can win in the long run because he's going to be able to point to the economic crisis, spend more money than any U.S. president's been able to do in the next 2 years in the guise of stopping the hemorrhaging of the economy. And we're all going to critique it later and say you were sloppy, there's moral hazard.
Right.
You know, we've nationalized key parts of the
and
economy.
And you're an Obama supporter.
I am a cautious Obama supporter.
So what do you want him to do? What should he
well,
do?
I want
is
Obama
it the
to go out.
Trains everywhere, or what?
No,
you
I
know,
think
the
this is a time for Barack Obama to get serious, and he's not getting serious enough. He's got to rewrite the domestic social contract in America, solve the inequality problem, figure out where workers are in this equation,
problem?
And it's simultaneously. It's not one or the other. He's got to write a new global social contract where we renegotiate the terms of trade with other great global stakeholders and how to make that happen.
But what's he going to do in February?
Do all of this in February.
I know, but I mean, seriously, like, what is a concrete plan to deal with, inequality in America? What is it?
Well, David Frum wrote a great piece in the New York Times magazine that outlined a lot of this. The problem we have in the United States is you've got to figure out how to simultaneously revitalize infrastructure development in the country, employ a lot of people, and then get the country back on a track where it doesn't need life support from the federal government. It's very bad to have the federal government driving, a job. You know, they started talking about 2 million new jobs.
There's literally billions of dollars of private capital ready to build toll roads, to build all sorts of infrastructure projects. That makes sense.
But right now there's no financing infrastructure for it because of the lack of trust.
Oh, no, that's not true. That'll come.
There's a huge lack of trust in the financial system right now. They're not loaning it. There's no – Obama – oddly, with that speech that he gave yesterday, is creating fear. This guy's got to create trust and figure out how you get people to be confident again, investing in the country, financing
each
other.
You don't pass massive infrastructure projects and saying, it's all about to go up in a mushroom cloud unless you stoke fear, right? I mean, FDR didn't pass the New Deal by saying, you know what, things are so great, believe in me. He was saying things are so bad, believe in me.
David, you've written a book, Comeback, about how the Republican Party can revitalize itself and actually be an important party again and be a party that wins again.
And possibly even be bigger than the Libertarian Party. And
I think we are overtaking on the left right now. When you look at, there's all this talk about Obama's first 100 days and these comparisons to FDR and the New Deal, what is a perfect scenario for you or a disaster scenario for you for the first 3 months of an Obama administration?
The thing I'm most frightened of is that he moves very fast and very recklessly. I don't think that's in his nature. But the essence of his political strategy is to blur the line between two ideas, between the need for a relief of the credit markets, even for an anti-recession fiscal stimulus. And then, as he said in his speech, he wants to do a second phase, and this is very much borrowed from the New Deal, where you use the crisis to make a case for ongoing government infrastructure spending. And if you can put those two things together, he's going to sink the finances of the United States.
Because when you say sink, you mean torpedo.
Do terrible damage to them. Mm. Because the spending he wants to do on the infrastructure side is not going to meet any kind of cost-benefit test. On the other hand, the things he has to do through the emergency, it doesn't matter whether they meet a cost-benefit test or not.
But what is he supposed to do? Because Bush has already started that process, and it's not clear that it's had the intended effect. And Hank Paulson was changing his mind every 15 minutes, it seemed. So what do you do?
I am very partial to a series of ideas that have to... We need to be conservative Keynesians, mm-hmm. and we need to understand the great legacy Keynes gave conservatives was dividing the microeconomy, the world of firms and individuals, from the macroeconomy, the world of credit instruments and interest rates. You need a lot of government intervention in the macroeconomy right now. I like the idea that the government should be essentially nationalizing Fannie and Freddie, buying up secondary mortgage paper, and taking these
things. Isn't that exactly what got us into this? And the monetary base has gone up by 40 or 50% over the past year. I mean, there's
The monetary base needs to go up a lot more. We need a deliberately created inflation. Because what we need to be able to say to investors is, right now you think you're safe if you keep your money in the mattress. You're not safe. You keep your money in the mattress, you're going to lose 6% of it every year. So you better go find something.
And then have you found the button, the reset button that Steve Clemens has talked about with the Obama presidency, where you say, okay, now we're dialing inflation back from 15% to...
In fact, when you need the next Paul Volcker to come in.
The fact that we've done it before, the fact that we've done it before shows that we know how to do it.
But, I mean, we did it before with a combination in the early 80s with Volcker and Reagan. Does anybody seriously think that...
In the early 80s, we didn't know how to do it. We had never done it before. We'd never had a disinflation, a conscious policy disinflation before.
But, I mean, there is no way that... Is there anybody on the political horizon who would withstand the pressure that Reagan did, the political pressure in you know, allowing interest rates to rise?
Who was willing to come in
started ahead of time. Yeah. I mean, and Carter actually pulled the plug on the early attempts by Volcker. Well,
if you have a dangerous disease, and I've got a pill that can deal with it that has nasty side effects and set in 6 months later, I give you the pill, and then I deal with the side effects. The first thing we have to do is pull the economy out of the deflationary spiral. But at the same time, we have to, and this is the thing I'd recommend to Republicans, the Republicans are in danger of doing exactly the opposite. They don't like the TARP, but they're tempted by the stimulus.
Well, they passed the TARP, though. That's
they don't like it, though, but they've been fighting, they've been kicking, and the House Republicans don't want to do it. But they're kind of tempted by the stimulus because the choice of Ray LaHood as Transportation Secretary, again, it's a Chicago move, that it's a signal Republicans, you get in on this, you buy into this deal, and
you get your cut.
The Republicans need to say, we don't want the long-term growth package. That's a no.
They need to say the seduction is corrupt.
But the TARP and the inflation, we need that. And we also need, and my AEI colleague John Macon is a big advocate of this, we need a payroll tax holiday, a 1 or 2 year payroll tax holiday. And that is a way of getting immediate relief, like tomorrow, into the hands of the lowest
income workers. Everything David is saying is not enough, because the other problem in this equation is that we have an equation in America where workers are overconsuming and underproducing, while Germany, Japan, and China are overproducing and underconsuming.
Are you overconsuming? This is part of the unseemly side of Obama, he's a moral scold. You know, it's like, oh, you know, you
it's
guys are spending
scold.
Too much. Sure,
it's
he is.
The global economy. Is essentially what the subprime crisis
so
did.
In other words, we've got to pump all this money into the credit markets, but then not actually use the credit on anything.
I'm sorry,
right? We have to pump all this money into the credit markets so that nobody actually borrows in order to
borrows to finance consumption, but people do borrow to finance investment. That's not such a complicated idea.
But these are not the right lines. I mean, should they not buy houses?
No, there's a collapse of demand in the world, though. I'm saying is I agree with most of what David just said.
What are you investing in if not production, which then becomes consumed goods or services?
The line between investment and consumption at the very, it's like any legal line, at the very point where the line meets. Yes, it gets blurry. But you know when you are well on this side and well on that side. These are concepts that, although they can be very difficult to define on the classroom chalkboard, in theory they are a little bit hard to define. In practice, they work well. And when America has a savings rate of under 1%, I think it's fair to say the country is consuming too much. And that has and
what should the savings rate be?
Higher. More.
Higher.
We'll know it when we see it.
Well, should it be like the Japanese savings rate?
Probably not as high as that.
And that their economy hasn't worked out so well in terms of savings versus consumption.
They have different economy, the Chinese economy.
Let's take a break. We'll come back to this. And in the meantime, please go out and buy those wheelbarrow stocks, because it sounds like inflation is coming and we'll need something to keep our money in.